Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hard Hits. I'm your host, Derek Felix, and over the next half an hour on our sports podcast, I'm going to be going over some big happenings here in the sports world. It is a good morning to everybody out on the East Coast here in Staten Island, New York City. And how is everybody out there? I hope everybody is doing well. This is a short abbreviated edition of the Hard Hits podcast. First show in a while, so it's good to be back. And right in the middle of summer, a lot of humidity out there. Certainly a lot of heat, especially here in New York. Mid-80s, sometimes it feels like it's about 94, 95 with the humidity. We did get some thunder showers, finally. Hopefully we'll get some more rain in the forecast. But it is good to be back, and good show for you, certainly. A lot of stuff going on with baseball. Of course, they are at the All-Star break right now. First games are not until Friday. The Yankees and Mets will be hooking it up at the new stadium for a three-game set. On Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And the Yankees, 29 games over 500, 4.5 games out of first place behind the Red Sox, who are just rolling everybody lately. So they're going to try to make up ground there. The second wild card is the Seattle Mariners. I think they're up by about 4.5. Also in the Oakland Athletics, who have been red hot. They entered the All-Star break, winning 20 of their last 24. Yeah, if I was the A's, I definitely would be looking to see if I could add somebody, because it's possible. It's very possible that the A's could overtake Seattle. It wouldn't be easy to do, obviously, but stranger things have happened, and I'll tell you what. I thought the A's would be competitive this year, and I'm really not that surprised. Maybe I'm surprised that they won as many games as they won, especially on this hot streak, because they got off to kind of a cool start. But they're the team to watch out for in the AL West, not the Angels, who, as usual, are just underperforming and injuries and whatever other excuses you want to make. If not Mike Trout's fault, he is the best player in baseball. It's just the way the Angels are. A little bit of bad luck with Pujols running into an injury. After he finally started to look like the old Pujols, having a two home run game where he had two bombs, 410 plus feet in a win. They got Justin Upton. He knocks out a lot of runs, and they got Ohtani back, who would have been right in the thick of the AL rookie race with Gleyber Torres and Miguel Andujar, the two Yankee rookies. Torres expected to possibly be back for this weekend. So we'll find out if he's back for that or if they're going to hold off and maybe wait until they play the Red Sox again. So because they hook up with them afterwards and they're holding Severino back for that. So we'll see. But the All-Star game was a game I really didn't watch. I'm not really a guy that watches All-Star games anymore. It's too bad, too, because it turned out to be a pretty good game. A game that was basically a home run derby in itself. It was a great home run derby last night, or I should say the other night now, since we are on the East Coast, but won by Bryce Harper, the hometown hero in Washington, D.C. Will it be his final year in Washington? God, I don't know. I mean, he does have the 23 bombs, but he still has the great on base, but when you're hitting 212, 213 with a lot of strikeouts, almost 100 strikeouts, I don't know what's going to happen with Bryce Harper. I don't know what the Nationals are going to do there. So, I'll tell you, Bryce is a show stopper. He's from Vegas. He knows how to give a good show, and he certainly gave a great show. That home run derby was excellent, actually. I picked Kyle Bates-Schwarber, a guy that I think is made for the home run derby. He did not disappoint. He really didn't. He made it all the way to the final. And I felt like he needed to hit 20 home runs. If he hit 20, I think he maybe would have edged Harper. Maybe. Or maybe he needed to hit about 22. But he came up a little short of that after he wound up with 18 home runs. And Harper looked like he was in deep trouble. He was down 18-9 with, I don't know, a minute 26 or a minute 30 on the clock when he used the second time out. And his dad was pitching to him, and that in itself was always fun to watch. So I remember when Robinson Cano had his dad, former Major League Jose Cano, pitch to him, and he won the derby. And that was awesome. Well, it turns out Harper was just unbelievable in that final minute. It didn't look like anything was going to happen. And then, boom, 9 straight home runs. 9 home runs. 9 home runs on 10 swings. And just like that, he tied it up. And on a second swing, with the extra 30 seconds, the dead center. And he walks off and wins 19-18. And I thought it was a great event. You had some good matchups, too. Javi Baez getting edged by Max Muncy. Muncy went off to catch him and pass him. That was pretty cool. That was a pretty good one. Schwarber. Yeah, Schwarber was fun to watch. Bregman. He did it advance. But I'll tell you what. I had a lot of fun. I thought I had a lot of fun watching it. Reese Hoskins was great. How about him, huh? Knocking out Jesus Aguilar. The kid who came from nowhere to be right in the MVP race for the Brewers, for the Brew Crew, who are currently the best record. Wait, did the Cubs pass them? I think the Cubs might have passed them. But I'll tell you what, Reese Hoskins put on a great show, but Schwarber was able to edge him. But Bryce Harper, we're in the, I don't know if it was a tribute to Bruce Springsteen or. Well, he is from Washington. He plays for Washington, D.C. for the Nationals. And I love the whole All-American look with the bandana. It looked like something out of Bruce Springsteen from 1985 when the boss was dressed up the same way with the bandana. He had the All-American theme. I thought it was really cool. It was kind of similar to the 4th of July, with the socks that they wore. And that was awesome. That was awesome, actually. Yeah, so that was a lot of fun to watch. And Harper, I'll tell you, he gets really excited. And I know it hasn't been his year, but look, this is a guy that should be doing a lot better as far as the hitting. We'll see what happens in the second half. The Nationals are, what, a 500 team? Or they went under 500 and they're like 6 out right now? Yeah, I think they're 5.5 out for 48. And yeah, that division is very winnable. The Phillies and the Braves, they're not really going anywhere. I mean, they're not going to run away with it. Both those teams are good teams, surprise teams. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the second half with that race, if the Nationals can figure it out and get going. You've got a good, you have an excellent race in the NL Central. The Brewers have, you know, had a terrible series against the Pirates, a terrible Pirate, and have lost six in a row. And they went from being in first for basically the whole year to being out of first place. They're 55-43 after being, I think they were what? They were 18 games over 500 and had the Cubs by 2.5-3 games. And now the Cubs are 2.5 games up and 5 in the loss column. Brewers have played 5 more games than the Cubs. The Cubs are 55-38, led by Javi Baez, who is an MVP candidate if he continues to do what he's doing with the 19 home runs and the 17 or 18 stolen bases, on pace for that 30-30, looking like a shoo-in for over 100 RBIs. He's not the favorite to win the MVP. I think that would be Freddie Freeman from the Braves. Just a steady hitter, a terrific hitter. He was in the home run derby. He's not really a home run guy, even though he hits home runs. So it didn't really work out for him in the derby. But I thought the participants were excellent. You got some good MVP candidates. I mentioned Baez, but he's probably about fourth or fifth right now behind the likes of Freddie Freeman. Ozzie Albies, the excellent young second baseman for the Braves, with he like 20, and he's just unbelievable. I think he would definitely be a candidate for it. Jesus Aguilar is definitely in the hunt. And from the NL West, I mean, if he continues to hit the way he always hits and field the way he does, obviously Nolan Arenado would be a candidate. He's never won it, but he's an excellent ball player. And his splits are pretty good, actually. I have to be fair about that. His splits are very good. Paul Goldschmidt, I think it's up to 21 or 22 home runs. You shouldn't discount him either, and Matt Kemp. So I pretty much set it up there. There's about 6 guys competing for the MVP. We kind of broke it down right there. So those are your 6, basically. The game itself, the All-Star game, 8-6, the AL winners, almost every run was off a home run. That was crazy. And that's just the way baseball's played now. There was a sac fly. I think that was the only run that wasn't produced by a home run. So every other run. Judge, by the way, the judge, Aaron Judge, who had been ice cold coming in. What does he do? He hits a Max Scherzer pitch and takes it out to deep left. And he hits a home run off Dollar Max, off Max Scherzer. The premier pitcher in baseball, even though his ERA is a lot higher than Jacob DeGrom's. DeGrom's had the best year in my book. It doesn't matter the fact that he pitches for the Mets. I know you have the ERA that DeGrom has. You have to say that DeGrom should have the inside track to that Cy Young. How many wins can he get to that? That's the question mark. Is he going to be penalized for being a Met? I mean, right now, I'd probably say they'll give it to Scherzer. And DeGrom's going to probably get screwed out of it. Felix Hernandez once won the Cy Young with maybe 13 wins. I think it might have been 12 or 13 wins off. Check that out. 8-6 was the final. It was an extravaganza of home runs. Judge, Trout, off the ground. You had all sorts of guys just leaving the yard in this game. The big blow after it tied it at 2 was a 3-run home run, actually, by Gene Segura, the superb shortstop for the Mariners, came up and hit a bomb against Josh Hader. Of course, the NL was able to come back a little miraculous there with Trevor Story from the Rockies and then Christian Yelich in the 8th inning. And then what happened? Schooner Gennett turns it around and ties the game with a 2-run home run off of Edwin Diaz, the excellent closer for the Mariners. This was a home run extravaganza. So think there were about 8 home runs in total. Let's just total them up here. Contreras, Story, Yelich, Yanet, Votto. Joey Votto also hit a home run in the tenth, in the bottom of the 10th inning to get the Nationals one more run back. And you had Judge, Trout, Bregman, and Springer. Bregman and Springer were back-to-back jacks that gave the AL the final count there for their 8 runs. Two superb Astros right there. Juice can rake. Alex Bregman can rake for a Jew. All right. Gotta love those Jewish sluggers. So, and we all know that we know how good and how consistent George Springer is out of that leadoff spot for the Astros. Terrific. And both him and Bregman are terrific pull players. So I guess there what was there, 9 home runs in this game? That's crazy. Really is. But that's the way these both been played. Ross Stripling's actually had a great year for the Dodgers, but he took the loss. And he's got a great ERA this year. And Hader got knocked around. Hader's been awesome for the Brewers. 1/3, 4 hits, 3 runs, 1 earned. Bottle made an error. So, you know, if you were a pitcher, you had to be careful of the you weren't too careful of the sluggers that you were facing. But Severino pitched a scoreless inning and 2 strikeouts. Arcia, a strikeout an inning. Blake Snell gave up a home run in 1 2/3 innings. Jay Happ did give up a solo shot to Votto, but got the save. Diaz actually wound up the win after blowing the save. Okay, so it is what it is. It's an all-star game. Really not much else to say. I guess the one thing I'll say, nice tribute, great tribute there, what they did there for the for all the people fighting cancer and you know, before the 6th inning, about after the 5th inning ended. I like that, where you had all the players with the signs, I fight for, and yeah, I think that's pretty cool. So, I didn't really watch much of All-Star Game, but I did catch that part, and I'm glad I caught that part because that part's pretty emotional and it's pretty good to watch. And I think that's what it really should be about. And I like the fact that they have that. I mean, I don't like Joe Buck all that much, but that was nicely handled, though. So, good stuff right there. So the AL won 6 straight. And doesn't it always go like this? Where, you know, one league, you know, just wins 5, 6 in a row, and they just do what they have to do. You know, we talked about the home run derby, and I thought it was pretty cool to watch Bryce Harper come back against Schwarber and win. I was pulling for Schwarber, but it is pretty obvious. Once Bryce got on a roll and hit those 4 in a row, I was like, oh, my God, he might come back. And God almighty, it was just awesome. What an awesome display. And the thing about him is that he's not what I would call a – he just has natural power. I mean, he's just got that stroke where it just jumps off his bat. It's like watching Griffey Jr. That's why I just can't believe that he could be hitting as well as he's hitting. And hopefully for him, you know, jump starts him because he's been a real disappointment for the Nats. And if he was hitting, you know, about 40, 50 points higher, I'd have to think the Nats are probably right there in first place or tied for it or maybe even in first place at this point. So, this is the sports podcast with Derek Felix on Hard Hits Network here. And it's great to be back in mid-July. 424-675-8226. I'm really not taking calls. I don't even know if anybody even listens right now because I'm just trying to rebuild my audience. I'm going to swing to a couple other things. Manny Machado. Everybody's been talking about Manny Machado. Oh, Manny Machado this, Manny Machado that. He was never going to be a Yankee, okay? There was no way the Yankees were going to trade for him. It made no sense. He's going to be an unrestricted free agent in the winter unless he decides to re-sign with the Dodgers, which is where he's going to be going. So I really thought, like, a great place would have been Milwaukee for him. You know, they don't really have a shortstop there. It's not a good situation there. Their shortstop has fallen apart there. Arcia has bombed this year, and I don't know what the hell they're going to do. But Milwaukee was in on him, so were the Phillies. You know, they were both interested, but it didn't work out that way. So It is what it is. But the Dodgers are going to give up one of their top prospect. There goes my little lemon here, my thing. It's pretty cool actually. My device, it just makes those cool sounds. So, it is what it is. Just to touch the base. I mean, what that could mean for the for that race in the NLS. Well, I mean, the Dodgers are trying to get by the Diamondbacks, and that whole division is really close, really tight. You got the Rockies and the Giants, and there's like four games separating, first four. Padres are a rebuilding team. Ooh, but they can play smaller. They play all right. So they can. He's a great player, Manny Machado. He really is. It's not surprising that he'd be having the great year that he's been having. And I kind of feel bad for Oriole fans because, it's like they're getting robbed of a great player. Yeah, I mean, they're going to get a great package back from the Dodgers. But, man, oh, man, replace a guy like Manny Machado. It's just, it's sad, really. It is. And I have to be fair. Yeah, I don't like Angelos, and I just think that's a terrible job. And I mean, you gotta keep him, but it is what it is. Everybody knew Manny Machado was going to be available, and he's going gone. He's going to Hollywood, and of course it would be the Dodgers. And I figured it out last night. I was like, you know what? Yeah, for that, I was like, he's going to the Dodgers. And so he's going to the Dodgers. We don't have Corey Seager at shortstop, so they decided they want to trade for Manny Machado. And whether or not he stays there, God, I guess they would have to get creative and make some other trades in the offseason if they wanted to. I've made this little small prediction that Bryce Harper will wind up a Dodger also, and they'll make some trades. Maybe they'll trade Yasiel Puig and maybe get rid of Justin Turner. I don't know. I mean, strange things have happened. But Manny has one of the best gloves in baseball. He doesn't really strike out that much. He only has 51 Ks, 45 walks. He's hitting .315. He's never hit over .300 in his career. The highest was .294 when he had 37 bombs and 96 RBIs in 2016. He has 24 home runs at the break with 65 RBIs, and it looks like that's going to be it for the Orioles with the .315 average and the .963 OPS. He never even had an OPS over .900 in his career, as great as he is. So he's going to get sick money in the offseason. Will it be with the Dodgers, or will it be another team? I don't know. I can't really answer that right now. The Dodgers willing to pay a hefty price for the just-turned 26-year-old who had played most of his career at third, has been playing shortstop, which is his natural position. That's what he wanted to do. And, good luck to him, obviously. It's a big help to the Dodgers when you have Max Muncy. This year's Cody Bellinger story. Bellinger is only hitting about .245. He does have about 18 or 19 home runs, but he's been a little bit of a disappointment. Jacques Peterson, he can only hit against righties. His power numbers are good, but he can't hit lefties. So they got Kai Hernandez. Kai Hernandez played very well for them, but I don't think they want to play him every day. I think that's one of the reasons why they made this move. Justin Turner is back, and he obviously makes a difference. If there's still some question marks with the staff, especially Kershaw, how effective will he be in the second half? How many more injuries can he rebound from with his back? That's the question. You worry about Kershaw. He's getting up there. So Stripling's been terrific. Jansen, out of the bullpen. Maybe the Dodgers make one more move for a pitcher. That would make some sense, possibly. So we'll see what happens there. Obviously, I mean, you put Manny and Chano in the middle of that order, it's going to make a huge difference, especially with those lefty bats. And then you add him, and you also have Yasiel Puig, your righty bats, and Grandal as well. Gary lineup right there. So that's pretty much it. That's pretty much what I'm going to say about Manny Machado for now. Hey, I mean, he deserves to be on a team that's committed to him. So, but, you know, they will be getting the Orioles' top prospects, at least. There's at least that. And here, and this is what it looks like, according to Michael J. Dworthis 3 hours ago. Yosnel Diaz is the top prospect. Dustin May and Errol Robinson. That looks like what it will be. But it's not official. We know Yosnel Diaz, the number one prospect for the Dodgers, is in trade. That I do know. What I'll try to do is maybe get some numbers on him. This is a podcast. It's only live for another 2 minutes. I will do some overtime. If you've never listened to the show before, I usually will do overtime, especially if it's a short podcast. And the overtime segment usually runs for another half an hour, you know, so it depends on the time. I'll probably do about 10, 15 minutes. I'm going to do some stuff on Wimbledon with Novak Djokovic getting back in the winner's circle. I think that was a great story in itself because nobody really expected it. But when I saw him beat Nishikori, I was like, you know what? He looks pretty good. It looks like he actually might. I thought he might be able to do it, especially after Nadal had to go so far and long against Del Potro in that great, great quarterfinal. And then they had to come. And he has to come back and play in a 2-day quarter semifinal against Djokovic that goes even longer. Yeah. And Kevin Anderson was just at a disadvantage after playing for 6.5 hours against Isner. And that, yeah, they got to do something about the tie. They got to put a tiebreak in at some point in the fifth set. That's not fair. They're out there too long. Look what happened to Nadal and Djokovic. They had to play 2 days. That doesn't make any sense. That's inconvenience. And that inconvenience, the women's final also. Serena, I don't know if it affected Serena, but she just wasn't herself. You can see it. And Angelique Kerber, full credit right there. Her third slam, not bad. I mean, she's only one away from career grand slam. Not bad for someone that started winning at, what, 28 or 29 with the U.S. Open and then an Australian Open. And lost in Serena in the women's final 2 years ago. Serena was going to try to tie Margaret Court, or actually go past Margaret Court for the most ever. But she loses in straight sets to Kerber. So that will do a little work up as well. I'll talk a little more in depth of that in the extra overtime. You know, for anybody that actually listened, thank you. And what we'll do is we'll go into overtime now. So, overtime is sponsored by what else but Brass Bonanza. So, okay. Hardhits Network. This is the podcast here with Derek Felix, and we just did half an hour live there. Talk mostly about Major League Baseball, All-Star Game, 8-6 final for the AL, and the Home Run Derby. And after the Great Home Run Derby with Bryce Harper winning in Washington with the Rock and Roll USA headband, bandana, wherever you put the bandana, look like Bruce Springsteen. That's pretty cool. Great Home Run Derby there. He edges Kyle Babe Schwarber, my guy, who I picked. He did a great job, but Bryce Harper was a little better. The Showman from Vegas, kind of like Andre Agassi. Yeah, Agassi was from Vegas, too. It was a little bit of Showman as well until he got a little more professional and his career turned around. But, you know, we've talked baseball. We talked about Manny Machado. The main prospect in this trade, you know, that's when it does become official with Machado becoming a Dodger, oh my God, doesn't the Dodgers get everybody? They really do. All right, so another Manny goes to the Dodgers. It was Manny Ramirez once, and now it's Manny Machado in his prime. There's no Diaz. is from Havana, Cuba. He is 21 years of age. He's been in the minors for only a couple of years. And so far, he's doing pretty good for Tulsa. 220 at bats, 59 games here. He's got a 314 average. So that's the run scored, 36 runs scored, 69 hits, 220 at bats, 10 doubles. I have to do it by each thing because I'm on my minorleaguebaseball.com. 4 triples, so he's got some speed to him. And home runs, 6 home runs. So this is a guy who's a good hitter. And 30 RBIs. What is he? He's a right fielder, actually. 6'1", 195 pounds listed, and he's a right fielder. Okay, so he's got really good. He's got good numbers. 105 total bases. And if anybody's wondering, let's look at the walks. 41 walks. Well, that's very good. Only 39 strikeouts. So he's got a couple more walks and strikeouts. How about steals? 8 steals. So this guy looks like he's a pretty good player. It's got to be pretty good. Yeah, it's 428. And let's see what else we got here. How about his OPS? 905. Yeah, I figured it'd have to be over 900 with what I looked at there. So this guy's pretty good. He's done pretty well so far. So, yeah, he plays for Tulsa. So why don't we look? Why don't we take a little look at the previous year, his OPS was 881, so he only played in 31 games. But, he also played in rookie. Yeah, all right, so he split up. Okay, so I really wanted to look at it, and I wanted to get a better look at it. What I could do is I could go to baseballreference.com, so I'll just quickly do that. He's playing for the Tulsa Drillers right now. So we can go to his breakdown, and we can actually look and what the numbers look like a little more physically. So that's what we'll do, is we'll go and check the numbers for Yusmel Diaz on the Baseball Reference site, since this is the main guy in this trade. It's going back to the Orioles, they need an owner that's committed to winning. I don't understand what the heck they're doing, but imagine if the Mets trade DeGrom or traded DeGrom. I think you're Steve Sobers from WFAN. He's been around forever, and he's right. You keep your star guys. You get rid of the crap. That's what you should do. Double A, by the way, Tulsa. So, yeah, I figured he was playing double A. So he's double A already. After playing mostly – actually, he did play a little bit of double A for Tulsa last year. And hit 333, so this guy is not that far away, actually, already. I mean, he's doing good, and he's doing very good in Double A. You know, who knows? Maybe his arrival, he could arrive maybe later this year, but definitely, I would say, at some point next year, he should arrive. So, at least this guy, the looks of it, it looks like he's on the fast track to arriving. How could the Orioles screw him up? That's the question. Now, what's the story with Adam Jones? Do the Orioles have any plans to bring him back? He's not hitting as well as he used to. And he always was a free swinger, but he'd been an excellent Oriole. He's been an excellent Oriole. Terrific fielder, obviously. And that was a great trade right there. I'm trying to think back now. They traded away a pitcher that just didn't evolve into the kind of starter that we thought he was going to be. That was one of those trades that, yeah, everybody, I remember the pitcher. I liked the pitcher, but they wound up being a great trade for the Orioles. What's Adam Jones about? 30? He's 32. 32. All right. So he's 6 years, $85.5 million, and hits free agency. So, that's what he was making around, making a little less than $15 million, about $14 million actually. So, a little over $14 million a year. 4-time Gold Glove winner, 5-time All Star. So, I mean, he's had a very good career. Yeah, he's not doing so well this year. He's 32. You know, that's part of it. He doesn't walk a lot, so that doesn't help. He's hitting .275 with the 10 home run, 36 RBIs. And look, when you get up in that age, unless you're doing PEDs, yeah, I mean your numbers are going to drop off. He plays a lot of games for the Orioles. He has 100 RBI season, a couple of 30 home run seasons, 261 for his career. It's pretty good. 851 RBIs, 89 stolen bases, a career average of 277. I mean, and he's won some gold gloves. So he's been an excellent ball player for them. I guess the real question is, because they're probably going to move on from him, who's going to sign a guy like that in the offseason? He'll be 33 on August 1st. So what kind of payday can he look for? I don't think it would be that long-term a contract. I mean, he looks like he's on the way down. He's still a guy that will give you about 25 home runs and knock in between 75 to 85 runs. So he can still do that for you. But of course, playing for the Orioles doesn't help. You know, they already committed all that money to Chris Davis. Wow, that was a disaster waiting to happen. I don't know why they did that. I mean, we knew what kind of player Chris Davis was. The trade, by the way, was listen to this. It was for Eric Bedard. Eric Bedard, the lefty, a guy that was traded to the Mariners, and once he went to the Mariners, it was disaster. He was not the same pitcher. After he was good for the Orioles, and I remember at the time I thought it was a good move for the Mariners, but look what they gave up. They gave up Adam Jones. It was back in 2008, before the 2008 season, and Chris Tillman also. So that was a really great trade for the Orioles, and it turned into a disaster for the Mariners. So Tillman, by the way, is still with the Orioles. Tillman has been a solid starter for them, but he's been hurt. He has been hurt the past couple of years, and he's on the DL again. And so he's starting and on the DL with a lower back strain. So the last couple of years have been rough, and that might explain part of why the Orioles have gone from a team that was, you know, a very competitive team on the books older to a very bad team. You know, despite the fact that they had some good ball player. Well, of course, when you have the other performance of Chris Davis and you have Mark Trumbull, not exactly the same player after hitting all those home runs. There's just a lot of things wrong with the Orioles these days. And how about the performance of their second baseman as well? I mean, a guy that I thought was on the way to stardom and had a great year last year, and I thought maybe Pete for the MVP, and he's terrible this year. So, and I can't think names right now, but I'm actually looking up the Orioles as we speak. So, I mean, why not? I'm talking about Jonathan Shoup. I don't know what's happened to him. He's with the .220 on average. I don't know what's that all about. 10 home runs, 25 RBIs. He had a great year last year. Trey Mancini only hitting .216 with 12 home runs. Tim Beckham was excellent when they got him from Tampa Bay. He's been terrible this year. Terrible. .206. So there's just so many guys underperforming, and Chris Davis is a disaster. 158 with 116 strikeouts, a .232 on base, a .506 OPS for your first baseman, and he signed for another like 5 years. Catcher is a disaster as well. Chancisco got sent down for now. He's got two home runs. He's a first round pick. Are they going to screw him up as well? I don't know. Trumbull, by the way, 12 home runs, 20 RBIs, .251. Valencia has, off the bench, is pretty solid, .251, 9.27. So he's one of the guys. For Caleb Joseph is their other catcher. When you got three home runs out of your catcher spot, you got problems. God, I bet they wish they had the Yankees depth. You know, Sanchez out, and you look at Austin Romine, and you look at Hayagoshu. They have great depth. So there are a lot of things wrong. Dylan Bundy's taken a step back this year after a really good year last year. He's got the 4.35 ERA. He's been giving up more walk balls this year. The strikeouts are there. but he's been prone to the bad inning this year. So that's part of the problem for him. Kevin Gausman is a guy that pitches to contact. So he gives up more hits than innings. Caster is a guy that should be basically your fifth starter. He's your third star. Alex Cobb, they signed. He's been a disaster. They just have a lot of problems. They have a lot of guys that just have problems. Britton just returned. Britton's a guy they could get something good for. Their closer, obviously. He's going to get moved. So I'm sure somebody will get him. He's a great lefty, too. So he's a great weapon to have. It's just a question of who will get him. I think the Indians would be a good landing spot for him because they have no bullpen at all, especially since Andrew Miller went down. They could use another guy out of that bullpen. So just some food for thought. 20-69, I mean, that's the worst record in baseball. So just to get into the Wimbledon and the World Cup, my thoughts on Wimbledon, I mean, it was a little disappointing. There weren't a lot of quality matches, especially on the women's side. When you have all the top seeds going out like that, it's not that good. It's not good when everybody's like losing. When Halep's losing early after she won, following what her first slam. And yeah, I understand, the turnover from the French Open and Wimbledon can be pretty tough. And that's why it's very hard for someone who wins the French to win Wimbledon and turn around and win both. And that's true of the men's side too. I mean, when you look at the history, Borg and Nadal done it. Did Djokovic do it? I'm trying to remember. He might have. I actually got to look that up. But it's really hard. You have to be a great player to do it. So, Kvitova going out and her rankings dropping. And I really like watching her play. But, since she got stabbed, and God, that was really sad. And thankfully, she didn't want to come back. She's been up and down. So, I mean, there are some really good top players. Muguruza is a terrific player, and she disappointed after a semifinal appearance in France. When she go out? She go out in the first or second round after winning last year's Wimbledon. So, yeah, I mean, she's like a hot and cold player. She's really, I think she has the talent to be a number one player. So, I don't know if Azarenka will ever get back to the level. I saw her compete with Serena for slams and win a couple of slams, but yeah, she's got to get that ranking up. Wozniacki also lost early, which was disappointing. So everything opened up. Madison Keys was disappointing. There was a possible potential in round of 16 against Serena, and that never happened. Venus lost early. And St. Stephens, after a really great French making the final for losing to Halep in three sets, and she loses early. So we'll see how she does at the US Open. She's been a little up and down. So, but she did win at the Australian, so she has two slams. Madison Keats still has none, so that's a little disappointing. As far as the final, let me go to the final. I don't want to say that the start time, the fact that they had to wait for Djokovic and Nadal to finish was a classic match with them finishing the final two sets and 6-3 Nadal took that 4-7. The fifth set was, 9-7 Joker. Very similar to an Australian Open match they had a few years ago. But I think the waiting, I think that hurts, of course. But it was the same for both ladies. And Kerber handled it a lot better than Serena did. And Serena made a lot of unforced errors, and she just didn't have it. And maybe the expectation was too high. Yeah, I thought it was a foregone conclusion she would win, and she lost 3-3, and she wasn't herself, She wasn't herself after beating good-looking German Julia Gorgas 2-4 to advance. And Serena did have a tough quarterfinal against Camille Giorgi, coming back to win in three sets. But, maybe you don't forget, it was her fourth event, since returning, after having a child, and she had some she had a tough time there, just giving birth. So I mean, yeah, I think we forget. You know, maybe sometimes, you know, everybody just expected her to win, and you know, when I looked at the matchup, and I watched like none of the women's because I just didn't think it was all that good and worth watching. And when I saw that it was Kerber, I was like, you know what, rematch of 2016. They played competitive finals before, Kerber getting her in Australia and Serena getting her at Wimbledon. I was like, this is a final that I want to watch because I had a feeling it would be a good match. I knew Kerber would give her a good match. But, yeah, just looking at, I didn't watch the entire because I was flipping between that and some of the World Cup third-place game between England and Belgium. The game Belgium dominated and won 2-0 over England, so they really crashed after everybody thought it was all the cups coming home. Well, it didn't come home. They didn't finish in the top three. But, you know, they had a great run. And there was some great sportsmanship shown. But I just saw Kerber staying very consistent and able to actually run Serena around. Serena was missing wildly, and her serve wasn't totally on. And Kerber looked like the better player. And she won the first set. And she got up early in the second set, and she held her nerves. Serena tried to put some pressure on her and Kerber, and she was serving for it, but Kerber was just better, and it showed. And so here's the interesting thing. And I don't know. This is not good, obviously. Women's final ratings were up, so I think that's partially because I think there was two reasons for that. One, you had Nadal and Djokovic playing, finishing their match. Everybody had to be watching that, even though it was very early in the morning, and everybody was probably, so they probably got, they got some juice from that ESPN. So they had an 86% increase. So not surprising. And of course, everybody wanted to see Serena, see if she could get 25. However, and I don't think this is a surprise either, the men's final was way down. It was only a 0.9. It's down from 1.5. So this is the lowest since ESPN began broadcasting in finals in 2012. And I really think it had to do with expectation. Everybody, I think, knew that Kevin Anderson, after he had to expend so much energy just to get to that final, even though he had the day off on that Saturday, while Djokovic had to work hard, you know, in that, especially in that final set, and play very early before getting, you know, against Nadal, against Rafa in a classic. The fact that Anderson had to work so hard against Isner, 26-24, that was abnormal, okay? And that's the whole reason why you have to hope that they come to their senses and at some point have a tiebreak in that final set. You know, they don't do it at the first three majors. But when you're in the fifth set, at some point, if it's nine games all, yeah, and that's enough. You got to have a tiebreak. U.S. Open at least gets that right. I think you have to have a tiebreak. They can't keep going. At 9-7 should be the most. That should be the final. You have to win by two games. Now, Anderson also came back from two sets down against Federer in the quarters. A very similar match to the one where Federer lost to Tsonga. He blew that two sets to none, leading at Tsonga back in like 2012 or 13. So I think a lot of people, and I really did not watch, and I never miss a Mets final, but I just didn't, you know, I looked at the score, it was six, Djokovic took the first at 6-2, and so Djokovic got an early break in the second set, I was like, you know what, I'm going back to sleep. There's just, you know, when I saw that they got the early break, I was like, there's no reason to watch. And, you know, I got up, and Anderson, to his full credit, he got into a tiebreak. He had some set points against Djokovic in the third set. He could have pushed it to a fourth set. And he certainly raised his level, but he did the best he could. But Djokovic was a little too tough in the tiebreak, and he went to the match in straight sets. And, another thing, the final, don't forget, they were going up against the World Cup, too. And the World Cup being at 11 o'clock with France, you know, winding up winning their third World Cup, first in 20 years, really should have been their fourth. Zidane, the whole thing with Matt Arlovski, the whole trash talk and the headbutt. Oh my God, I'll never forget that in 2006. That was just disgusting. And he should have just held his cool there. I remember I was pulling for France in that game against Italy, and then he lost his cool, and they wound up losing in the kicks. But they also did go up against the World Cup, and France and Croatia were playing. World Cup's great. It is a great event. And that was part of it. Everybody knew Djokovic was going to win the final. And I think that was also part of it. And this is not a knock on Novak. Novak's a great story. The fact that he was able to come back after the injury to his elbow, the surgery he had to have. He didn't look like the same player earlier this year when he started his comeback. And the serve didn't look as good. And you just wonder, I mean, is he going to be able to get back to that level? And he has. And it's amazing. And it's a great story, obviously. And he was able to win. And his son actually was able to cheer for his dad at the end and see the trophy presentation. And he looks just like his he just looks just like his father, actually. It's pretty cool with his wife there cheering. And I think people knew. They knew that it was going to be lopsided. And when a diehard tennis fan like me just won't get up to watch, because I know. And I peeked on the scores. It's like, oh, my God, this is just a disaster. And I predict Novak to win his straight sets, but I was thinking more like maybe the first set would be a tie break 7-6, and maybe the second set would be 7-5. Djokovic gets a late break and win 6-2, third set. So I had almost 2/3 of the score right, but the other, you know, I mean, it was the first two sets were routine sets for Djokovic, and that definitely had to be a factor. And he's got 13 Grand Slams, first since completing the career Grand Slam when he won the French in 2016, and he's a terrific player. He's won away from Sampras in the 10-8 was the final, actually, the semifinal against Rafa, a five-hour match. Those are the two best players in the world, I believe, and nothing against Roger. Roger, you know, Roger's great, but Roger is also older than these two guys. And I think you watch the way Nadal and Djokovic were just going at it from the baseline. They were pushing each other so hard, and some of the points that Rafa won were unbelievable, incredible. He didn't take his chances. Blowing the tiebreak, that third set tiebreak before they had to take the break because they had the 11 o'clock curfew, 11-9, won by Djokovic, that cost him. He did come back and win the fourth set, and ultimately had some great chances, you know, had the early break opportunities, but when I picked it up later, you could just see that Djokovic was, it looked like he had just a little more left in the tank. He looked like he had a little more left. And maybe that's because he only had to go four sets against Nishikori, and it was a lot easier. It was less stressful. Rafa had to dig deep against Del Potro. And I do think that was part of it. And of course, Rafa would never say that. And Rafa just giving extraordinary effort. But I just think it was too tall in order. Some people mentioned the roof. Should they have played under the roof after playing the first three sets under the roof when you could play outside? Yeah, I don't know. But it was the same for both guys. And everybody said, you know, Rafa's a better player outdoors with the elements. And Djokovic likes it more indoors. But you can't say. You can't say who, for sure if Rafa wins because of that. That's hard to say. I'm not one of those people. It was the same condition for both guys. And they both knew what they were up against, and I think it was great. You know, but and Djokovic is a tough opponent for Rafa because he gives the same kind of effort every point. And he also likes to pound that forehand to the backhand, and even as good as Rafa is, you know, it's the same strategy that works against Roger. When Roger's not doing well. So, you know, a little disappointing. You know, of course, Andy Murray, you know, hopefully he'll be back for the U.S. Open. I hope that he'll still be a good player. Wawrinka, he played in the slam and had his upset early against Kyrgios, and Kyrgios is just an enigma. You know, the men's field's got a lot of talent, but, you know, it's still the same guys. And, you know, and at some point, you know, it needs to change. So that's what I'll say about that. There was a cute moment where Djokovic and Kerber. Kerber looked great with her red dress. Had a little cute dance for a minute. I watched that at the Champions Dinner, and that was really cute. So, Novak Djokovic with his fourth Wimbledon. And, hey, I mean, I think it's great to have Novak back. He didn't know if he would get back to that level, but he's back. And just double-checking, no, he only won that one French in 2016, so he's never won both French and Wimbledon in the same year. If he didn't get hurt, you know, he might be around wearing a dollar in the 17. You know, it's interesting. When you it's weird because you look at Novak, and he's always been great at the U.S. Open. But he only won U.S. Open twice, whereas he's won. He's dominated in Australia, winning six, and they play a lot indoors, and he's won four Wimbledons. He's got the one French and the two Opens, even though he's been to a lot of finals there, so... very interesting dynamic. The World Cup, I thought it was a great tournament. I watched almost every game. I wish I could have saw more of the final. I think France just had the best team. Yeah, I mean, they were very fast. Obviously, they had the young 19-year-old breakout star whose name I'll mispronounce if I don't look it up. It's Kylian, I think, Mbappé. So, and he's only 19, and he scored six goals the most. He's got charisma, and he's just got character. And he seems like a really excitable guy to watch. So I think it's great. That's great. Only 19 years old, be 20. Not until December 20th of this year, and a guy would be very exciting to watch. France beating Croatia 4-2, a game that they were up 4-1 in, and their refereeing again wasn't that good. That's part of the problem. You know, they're not always making the right calls. You're giving penalty kicks when they shouldn't. When they shouldn't be giving penalty kicks. So that's part of the problem. They had a great team. The games were so exciting, though. Croatia having the run they did, you know, beating England in extra time, that was great. That was awesome. No offense to the English, but I was going for Croatia. I wanted to see Croatia win. You know, I would have loved to have seen them win it. They didn't. How about the game against Croatia where they came back against Russia, the hosts? That was a great game. Russia comes back and they tie the game up in the second extras on the header, and then the guy, same guy misses the kick wide left, but he gets in the penalty kicks. Oh man, I'll tell you, goes from hero to goal. It's such a crazy sport. Everybody talks about Persian Pack, these other sports are not compared to soccer. Yeah, I mean, Brazil didn't go as far as we thought they would go. So, it's a lot. You know, Belgium beat them. They got them. And Belgium had a great run. So, I just think it's a very exciting game. Everybody says, oh, well, the games are a little scoring. It's boring. It's not boring. The theatrics are a little bit much. You know, when you see guys diving and just staying on the ground like they're shot. I mean, come on. Unless you really take, and sometimes you do take tough hits, get up. You got to get up. I mean, and play. But I think also, too, when you have, all right, you know, everybody was talking about, well, you've got the two star players, you've got the two studs. Ronaldo just got his transfer accepted. And Messi. But one player does not make a team. So Yeah, that, I think that's part. Argentina just wasn't that good, and it showed. They were lucky to even make it into the knockout stage. And Ronaldo, for as good as he was, Portugal, you know, they, it's not just one player, you know, that can just, you know, it's not like Pele. You know, soccer, you know, there's defense, there's so much running, there's luck. How about that one? How about that goal where it went right off the winning goal for Croatia, right off the back head, and it just took the right bounce, an unlucky bounce against England, right to the guy for the finish, and that's how they won. I mean, there's so much on the line, you know, when it comes to it, you know, obviously it's not going to be for another 4 years. But yeah, I'll be in my mid-40s. Scary prospect for me, but you know, yeah, I'll be almost 46 when the next time we see that World Cup. But you know, Perisic had a great tournament. Mandzukic, who got the other goal for Croatia, both those guys were clutch. There was also one off. You know, they also had an own goal. Mandzukic actually beat his own goalie in the penalty kick for Griezmann. He was an excellent player. Griezmann for France, one of the best players for them. A controversial one, mind you. But they scored. What happened was they scored three unanswered. So you want to blame the kick. You know, it had been 1-1, and you want to say, well, it shouldn't have been a penalty kick. It's too late. It's too late now. And of course, Mbappe got that big fourth goal, and they wound up winning 4-2. Congratulations to them. And of course, there were riots in France after. Yeah, we always talk about how, oh, but Europeans are so much classier than Americans. And yeah, I don't want to hear it. You know, and they're setting fires and they're doing crazy stuff. Come on already. I mean, could you behave a little? It was it was 20 years later since they last won in 98. I mean, come on. And you know what's funny? Aaron says, well, when you ever a soccer fan? You know, I'm getting texts from friends. I'm like, you know, the one thing I've always watched the World Cup. I watched it since 94, you know, when the USA upset Colombia. And, God, I wish the USA had an upset Colombia when you think about what happened there. The Escobars and, oh, my God, that poor Escobar. It's really sad. It's really sad when you think about it because of the whole of any because he scored an own goal and they fell apart and they murdered him family. And I watched the 30 for 30 and it's just the next one is gonna and I like the this is even more exciting. The next one's gonna be in Qatar. And in 2022 for this. Around Thanksgiving time. Yeah. November 21st to December 18th in 2022. Yes. Fire up some soccer in the winter, basically. Oh, my God. How awesome is that? That's going to be very exciting. It's usually a summer event, but you know what? Something about this being in the winter kind of juices me up, actually. It's kind of exciting, man, the fact that it's going to be later. Late fall with some, you know, cooler temps, and we're going to get to watch some soccer. I'm going to watch a lot more soccer because I do enjoy the sport. Dad refs it, and I do enjoy it. I don't like MLS because it's not the same. It's not as good. It's too much scoring, but I definitely enjoy it. So that's where I am on the soccer, and I hope the USA can get back into qualifying. I mean, look at all these other like countries that qualify. So who knows? But it's interesting that it's going to be around that time frame. So it's very possible that you won't see Ronaldo, you won't see Messi in 2022 because they'll be about 36 each or 35, or 6 and 35 years old. So who knows? But Mbappe is going to be around for a while. So the French are going to be a favorite. know, defending champs have had problems, qualify. I mean, look what happened to Germany. You expect that from Germany. Not being able to qualify. And that's happened before. It happened to Spain. I mean, but I think it just goes to show you how competitive. It's a very competitive tournament. That's what makes it great. Is that it is a really competitive tournament. And it's definitely one of the best tournaments to follow. So, you know, I could sit here blue in the face about how great the Stanley Cup is. And it's a really tough trophy to win. And it is. And I'm very happy that Ovechkin finally won one. But there's something about the World Cup. I don't know what the heck it is. Maybe it's just that I think it's even harder to win. You're not playing best of sevens. You're not. But every mistake is so much more magnified because it's one. If it's you make one mistake, and you could be out of the tournament. And I feel the same way towards Wimbledon. Wimbledon's always been unbelievable, and it might be the best tournament to watch. Grass court tennis. Well, they do need to do something with. They need to put tiebreakers into that final set at some point. You can't have players playing 5-6 hours. They can't be spending that much time on court. It messes up the schedule. That's exactly what happened with, because Isner and Anderson they couldn't break each other. It was crazy. I felt so bad for John Isner, the same guy who won 70-68 over Nicholas Bahut in that crazy first round match that lasted about 3 days. Man, he gave such a great effort. I listened to him talk about it. And I loved what he said about the effort he gave. He was very proud. God, wouldn't it have been something if he could have made the final? He was more tired than Anderson. He gave everything he had there to dig out of some of those games, but he just got too tired at the end. So in a year where you have Federer winning the Australian for his record 20th, Nadal winning another French Open for his 17th, Djokovic winning Wimbledon for his 13th. Yeah, they've all won. Who will win the U.S. Open? And that's the great question. Is it going to be one of the big three? Or somebody else going to sneak up there? Somebody else going to break through? I really like to see Del Potro. I'd really like to see Del Potro, to be honest. He's worked so hard to get back. I love watching him. It was heartbreaking watching him lose last year to Rafa after he beat Federer, got Federer in 5. And then again, another heartbreaking and crushing defeat to Rafa. This one a lot closer. And all the injuries that he's had to his wrist, and my God, the quality of that match against Rafa, even though it was only 6-4 in the fifth set, the points, the long games, it was awesome. And he was on the ground after they lost, and the dog gave him the big hug. And he said he wanted to stay on the ground forever, and Rafa, whatever the sportsman came across and gave him a huge hug. Juan Martín still only has that U.S. Open in 2009. If he didn't have all these injuries, he'd have about 5 or 6 majors by now. That I'm sure of. And I think it would be at least 3 U.S. Opens and probably about 2 Australians, possibly 1 on grass. But I definitely think U.S. Open Australia, he would have about 5. Maybe 5 majors, 6 at the most. And he'd be one of those guys. He's in the top 5. And don't forget about Marin Cilic. He's always really tough at US Open. Diego Schwartzman's a guy that's rising. Zverev's not had a good year. Team, home team, or Dominic team continues to be an enigma. There are so many good players on the men's side. And I have to think that the women, that it will be better, that the U.S. Open will hold more to form. And I have to think that Halep will play better. She usually steps up her game at the Open. Wozniacki usually plays her best at the U.S. Open. Carver is definitely a threat now because she's having a good season after how bad she was last year. Maybe that really helped her. She said it has. And so it should be a lot more competitive. I'm sure that Sloane Stephens being on that hard court will help. It's more to see how her and Keys play in the early rounds. They can survive the early rounds, get into that second week. Then you got to watch. And of course, you got Serena. You got Venus, Sharapova. Is Sharapova ever going to compete for a major? When you see that she's losing, you know, pretty early in some of these slams, can she compete again for one? And I don't know. There's questions there about her right now. Muguruza, always. I mean, how about Gorgas? Has she found something? Sharapova lost in the quarters, though, Roland Garros. But she was so disappointing in Wimbledon. You know, what is she in? Is she able to compete? I don't know. But I have to think U.S. Open will be better for the women. That's pretty much it. Del Potro. I really want to take him for the Open. But, of course, we've got a whole hard court season. We've got to see if he stays healthy. And we'll see what happens. See what transpires. So that's going to do it for this show. I'm going to be doing more shows. I'll make sure I do them a little earlier. Yeah, tomorrow night, I'm thinking around 11 o'clock we'll do a show. I'll do maybe an hour, 11 o'clock to 12. So we'll do a little bit earlier. That's going to do it for this show. I want to thank anybody that actually tunes in. Check out our podcast, and we'll be doing a lot more shows. And that's going to do it. So good to be back. This is Eric Felix from the Hardhead Podcast. And we'll see you all next time. A little tribute here to the Pantera drummer who just passed away. So a little Pantera that will take you out. Good night. Rest in peace, Vinnie Paul, the drummer and the originator of Pantera. Vinnie Paul was only 54 when he passed away back on June 22nd. You want to talk about a great band that, they get a lot of airplay, Pantera. And it's a shame, obviously, when a guy like that passes away. But they're a great band, so definitely listen to more of their stuff. And, Wassell added this song to the switchboard, and now it looks like it was symbolic. You never want to look at it that way. But I'm one of those believers in that kind of stuff. And, guess that's all I can only think about right now, but definitely check in for future shows and hold two fingers up high in the sky for Vinnie Paul. All right, this is Derek Felix for the Hard Hits Network, and thanks if you tuned in, and definitely stay tuned for more podcasts, more live shows. We're definitely going to do more of them, okay? See you later. Have a good day.